And now,
thank you.
So there's a hat going around. Thank you. We're really gratified that most of you came back for part two.
Yes.
We understand and appreciate that. So I'm just going to pick up where I left off a little bit. So I got sober. I was living with my mom and my dad because I couldn't go back to that apartment. I fell in with a great group of guys in AA. And like I said, I thought everybody worked the steps and got a sponsor and went to panels and went to jails and helped each other. That was the group of men. Two of them are sitting here tonight that I met in early sobriety. Bill was not my original sponsor. In fact, I went to a Tuesday night step study when I first got out of sober and got out of the rehab facility. And I remember I walked in, and it was a men's stag step study, and there was a circle of chairs, and way across the room, there was one empty chair. So I got to walk across the room, and I don't know how many people are in their first year of sobriety here, but I know that you believe that we're all looking at you and talking about you. Because I believe that. But I believe that for about 15 years of sobriety. I'm a slow learner. But I got my coffee, and I filled it up too much. So there was just surface tension holding the coffee in. And then I walked across that room and burned my hand and sat down and acted like it didn't hurt. And those guys all talked, and I didn't understand what they were saying, like Jay said. It was like Charlie Brown's teacher, you know, womp, 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 womp. But I was getting out of my parents' house because that's where I was living. So I left that meeting, went home, repaired my hand, went back the next week just because I knew where it was, right? I wasn't connected to them. I didn't know them. But something important happened to me because that was my first full round of meetings. And I got back to that meeting and that chair was empty and I filled up my coffee halfway because I went to college. And I ran across the room to the chair, sat down, turned around, and everybody that was there the week before was there again. And that said something to me because I was trying to get out of the uncomfortable place, my parents' house, and I had nowhere else to go. And I'm supposed to be going to AA. But there they were. Then they all talk like Charlie Brown's parents. I couldn't share because you can only share if you worked the step that they were talking about. Meeting was over. I ran home. Then one day I went into that meeting feeling just as uncomfortable as I'd been in early sobriety, just as self-conscious, still in debt all over the world, still hated by people that I was afraid of, still very cool reception from most of my old friends. I walked into that room and I sat down and somebody shared something revealing. They shared something personal and embarrassing. And I got a little bit excited because I thought, cool, now these guys will spend the rest of the meeting making fun of this guy, and this will finally be interesting. I did. And I come from that logically. My father was a great guy, really sensitive guy, war hero in World War II. But his idea of how to handle things, he dropped me off at school one day, and he said, "What's wrong with that girl's eye?" I said, "That's Mary. She has a glass eye." And he said, "Well, make fun of it. She'll get over it." It's Irish psychology.
Yes.
So that's what I thought people did. And in my house, if you revealed something vulnerable, we just mocked you. And I thought that's what people did. So this guy said this thing. I don't remember what it was. And I thought, right on, this will be great. It's men's stag. We can say anything we want. And then the next guy said, "I remember when I did that, but I was wearing ladies' underwear." And he got weirder and more vulnerable. And then another guy did that. And pretty soon I was, without even realizing it, witnessing spiritual love, maybe for the first time in my life. And all I did was go to an uncomfortable place to get out of another uncomfortable place. And I'll tell you what, I left that meeting, I had not said a word, and I felt cleaner inside. And I went to that meeting for 7 years, every Tuesday. Because something was happening in there that I didn't know of before. And I asked the guy in that meeting to be my sponsor, and he did what people do. He said, "Read the book, meet me at my house, we'll read it together." He had a little button on his gate. I'd push the button, the gate would open. I'd have to walk through the courtyard of his apartment building, and I believe there were people looking out the window going, "That's one of those lame alcoholics." And I did whatever he said, you know. He said one day, we would read until we got to a step, and we got to this one step, and he said, Now we're going to kneel down on my kitchen floor, and you're going to hold my hands, and I'm going to recite this prayer, and you're going to recite it back to me. So I'm realizing I'm going to be this close to this guy. And I just thought, wow, I didn't know Jeffrey Dahmer was my sponsor. And I'm not going to do that. And then he said, okay, you ready? I said, yeah. And I got on my knees, and I held his hand. I didn't want it to get too bloody. I thought, I'll just do what he says. And you know, we did it. And I got up. I said this prayer with this guy really closely and holding his hand. And I didn't get up and feel like confused with the Holy Spirit. I got up and felt like, hey, I just did something I didn't want to do because I want to change. That was huge. Seems stupid and little. It was huge. So what happened? I went to 3 meetings a day to get out of the uncomfortable place. And my life got cleaner. Remember when I held my child, I felt so filthy. And I believed when I got out of rehab, I'd go find some place to go sit and just face my sins and cry and wail and beat my chest. And AA had a better idea than that. One of the important things that happened to me in early sobriety was it was early, 60 days, 90 days. I was walking with my sponsor. He would give me rides to meetings sometimes because I had to borrow my dad's car because my AMC died a natural death. And we were walking to this meeting, and I said, you know, 3 months ago, I thought having Phoebe was the worst possible thing that could happen to me. And now it seems like such a gift and such a joy. I'm sober in AA, and I'm 60 or 90 days sober, right? I can't believe it, how great it is. I love her so much. And he just walked right into the meeting. Now, I'm self-centered, right? And I walk into the meeting, and I'm thinking, I did not know he was deaf in his left ear. I will approach him from the other side. So I watched him waiting for some sort of, you know, like, you're a good dude look across the room. And he didn't look at me through the whole meeting. And we went to the meeting and we got out and I got around his other side and I said, hey, maybe you don't understand because you don't have children, but I love that little girl more than I love myself. And he put his hand in front of me and said, please stop it. I said, well, stop what? And he said, how much child support do you pay? And I said, well, I work at a newspaper from midnight to 4 in the morning stacking papers on a loading dock. And then I sleep for a couple hours and I go deliver packages from 8 o'clock after the 7 a.m. meeting. I go at 8 o'clock to noon. Then I go to the noon meeting. Then I go home and sleep. And then I go to the night meeting. And then it starts all over. He goes, wow, I know all that. What I don't know is how much child support you pay. And I said, well, I don't pay any. And he said, then you're kind of full of it, huh? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, look, Matthew, you go to 10 gazillion meetings a week. You must know it's not a program of talk. This is a program of action. Why don't you show me you love your daughter? Then you'll never have to tell me again.
He was an asshole.
Well, we had a really quiet drive home. I was planning his death, and he was living in the present moment. And I got home, and I had this big poster, Eric Clapton, that I put up when I was 12, but I'm back. And he's full-size, remember, with the cigarette and the Stratocaster, black and white, kind of weird. Anyway, he was awesome. And I went in and told Eric what a dick my sponsor was, and because Eric and I were bonding when I lived with my parents. And, you know, I realized after a while that he was right. That's why I was so mad. I'm walking around my room pissed off with not a leg to stand on. And I called Anna and I said, Anna, I don't have much money, but I could give you some money and that if that would help. And she goes, oh, that'd be so great. This is so much harder than I thought, and I want to go to college. And I said, well, how much do you want? She said, well, let's not do that. Let's make it a percentage of your paycheck. So I, very smart girl, I thought, okay, that's fine because I made nothing. I worked at crappy jobs, and I live with my parents. She could have said, I'll take 80% of your income, and it would have changed my lifestyle not at all. I would not even notice. I would smoke one less cigarette a day, so whatever. So I said, okay. She said a very reasonable amount, and every 2 weeks I paid that amount. Every 2 weeks I paid that amount. Every 2 weeks, every 2 weeks, every 2 weeks. And then I come to these meetings where you guys all are, and I'd wait till the room filled up, and I'd come through the door, and you didn't jump up and applaud. And I was kind of bummed. And then I got the grapevine, and that there's no article. Matthew's paying child support. He's a hell of a guy. And I would, you know, I wanted a parade, right? I wanted a parade for doing the normal thing. And some of you are laughing at me and not with me, and I don't appreciate that. So let me bring it home for you. Remember when you're newly sober, 6 months sober, you get your driver's license, and you go up to your best buddy in AA, and you go, hey, man, I got my driver's license. He goes, hey, man, you're 40 years old. You should have a driver's license. But I'll tell you what, when Phoebe was a year old, I was playing with Phoebe, and I only paid that child support for two reasons, actually. I don't know exactly why I paid it. One reason is I never want to drink alcohol again, because I go to hell. I go to hell fast, and the worst part is I don't like me, and I hate me, and then I don't want to be around me, and then there's a gun in my mouth. And I'm surrounded by love when I'm not doing that. So that's number one reason. Number two reason is the only spiritual experience I was having my first year of sobriety, hands down, was sitting with Phoebe Rose. She had no agenda. She thought I was awesome. She pulled on my lips and my ears, and she laughed. I loved being with her. And I could walk by those parents of that teenage girl with some dignity, because I paid every 2 weeks. But nobody knew, and I did it every 2 weeks. And then a year in, I'm playing with Phoebe on the end of her mom's bed at her grandparents' house, and I'm like, Phoebe, I'm your dad. I'm going to take you to your first day of kindergarten. I'm going to take you to your first day of first grade. I'm going to take you to high school dances in my car, and then when you're old enough, I'm going to buy you a car. I'm going to try to figure out a way a loser like me can pay for college, because I love you and I'm going to know you for the rest of your life. Why do I tell you that? Because last session I told you that the first thing I said when I met my daughter was a prayer to God that she would never see me again. And that was a righteous prayer, because I was going to hurt him. Without even trying, I was going to hurt him. Well, what did I do? I went to meetings all the time, and I paid that money. And every time I got a raise, they got a raise. And I got a lot of raises. We never went to court. I always showed up. And Phoebe Rose and I are good, close daughter and father. She moved to Portland when we moved to Seattle. I see her a lot. She's the maturity level I am, because she's 23 years old and I'm 23 years sober. When she was 13, I think she was actually more mature than I was. Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah, whatever. Like the peanut gallery has to chime in. But I tell you this because that's what early sobriety was like. I did all this stuff and that it didn't make sense to me, like praying on my knees, like paying child support, like going to these crappy, you know, panels and you're getting there early, making the coffee, and amazing things happen. One of the things that was hard for me was I had a problem with the God thing, right? But I just explained that whole Tuesday night step study that the God thing happens to you. Those guys shared spiritual love, and I felt cleaner. I paid child support and became cleaner. You don't have to conceptualize it. You don't have to name it. You don't have to argue about it. If you're in here and you compulsively drank alcohol and you don't anymore, you have had a spiritual experience. But I said to my sponsor, I'm praying that prayer, relieve me of the bondage of self. I'm telling my sponsor about my prayer about self-centeredness. I just now realized how crazy that is. And he said, that's great, man. Why don't you help God out? Why don't you, and I go, well, how do I help God relieve me of the bondage of self? And it's like a magnet trying to attract itself or something. It's like my head hurt when he said that. And he said, well, why don't you do something nice for somebody and you don't tell anybody? I'm like, well, why would I do that? If I'm going to do it, I want to broadcast, you know. Like Jay says, you're an extrovert, Matthew. You think if you don't tell somebody about it, you think it didn't happen. And I hated it when he said that, actually. But so I went into the meeting that night. Big Monday Night Men's Stag, the meeting we love to brag about. And sometimes there's 100 guys in there. And we make an announcement at the beginning of the meeting. Is there anybody visiting from out of town? This guy raises his hand. He goes, I'm from Australia. I'm going to visit once a month. And I go, I'm going to relieve myself of the bondage of self by remembering his name in 30 days. That really is how pathetic I am. I thought that altruistic act would change me. So 30 days later, I forgot all about this guy, right? And I'm at the Monday night meeting, and I turn around, and he walks through the door, and it was like a high school dance. I'm like, Kevin, and I'm running across the room, knocking people out of the way. And I come up, I go, Kevin, my name's Matthew. Welcome back to the greatest meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. And he said, wow, you remember my name. That's impressive. He said, what do you do for a living? I said, well, I stack newspapers all alone, Doc, and then I deliver packages. And I'm very professionally fulfilled. And he goes, well, come outside. And we went outside, and he gave me his card, and he was vice president of an international airline. And he said, come to my office. Wear a suit. Bring your DMV. Bring your resume. I'm impressed with you. I did this little tiny thing to not think about me for 5 minutes. And God went, finally. Why don't we get you out of that shitty job? Jobs. So I went to his office, and I had a great black suit, really nice tie, really white shirt, because Irish people go to funerals. And I had hush puppy brown shoes. That's what I got, man. And he opens the door, and he looks at me, and he looks at my shoes, and he looks at me, and looks at my shoes, and he starts laughing. And he walks in his big, beautiful office overlooking Century Boulevard, and he goes, here's our human resources girl, this unbelievably hot Hawaiian girl. So I'm like trying to make my shoes disappear into the floor. And she looks at me, and she looks at my tie, and she looks at my shoes, and she looks a little tense. And then we go in her office, and I give her my DMV, which was a little thicker than this. That's my Department of Motor Vehicles readout. Because I'm so lame, I got arrested for the same DUI 3 times. I did. And I went in there, and we sit down. She's looking at my resume with this big gap of years of gone to the party, right? I got the DMV. She's looking at my shoes. She's looking at me. She's looking at my shoes. She goes, hold on just a second. And she gets up. I'm super nervous. And she goes in the other room into the vice president's office, my buddy, right? She goes in the office, closes the door, but the wall is right behind me. And I hear through the wall, I swear to God, I hear through the wall, he's not going to fly the goddamn planes. He's going to put people on them. I got super mellow. She came in quite tense. And she said, I think we're going to give you a job. I said, damn right you're going to give me a job. I need shoes, you know. No, I did not say that. I was very, very grateful to have that job. And I started paying more child support. And I started doing more stuff in AA. And these guys were blowing my mind. And one of the things that happened in AA is people showed me what having done a fifth step looked like in your life. People showed me what having done a ninth step looked like in your life. I gauged people by how comfortable are they, because I'm so uncomfortable. And it seemed to me these steps, you do the steps, comfort level goes up. You can stop, stay at that comfort level, but life will surprise you. One of the great surprises of my life was when I was still living with my parents, working at the airport, I bought a guitar on the way to work one day. I walked into there, to that office. I was almost perfectly on time for work, but I wasn't early, I wasn't late, and nobody trusted me because I got hired by the vice president and I didn't drink. But I've been the cool guy. Anybody been the cool guy at work? Yeah. Yeah, you got fired, right? Me too. So I went to the locker, I petted my guitar, it breaks, I peeked at it sometimes. Taylor, Dan Curry, single cutaway, beautiful guitar, you're jealous of me now. And I took it out to the curb that night. I'm standing at the bus stop, and I turn to the first person I see, and I say, hey, can I show you my new guitar? And it's this woman from British Airways. And she looks at me, and she looks at the case, and she says, I don't look at strange men's guitars, and gets on the bus. And I think, what an arrogant woman. She thinks I'm hitting on her. I am not. And I got on the bus, and she was pressed up against me, so she's uncomfortable now because this bus is packed. She's got a book in her hand called, it was Mere Christianity. I used to say it was Surprised by Joy, but we just talked about this the other night. She says, Mere Christianity. And I said, hey, I've read that book. What do you think? Because I wanted her to relax. And she said, well, do you believe in God? And I started vibrating. And I said, God saved my life. And all the color went out of her face. And she was nervous again. I thought, wow, I've blown it with this girl twice in 3.5 minutes. And she said, well, I'm on the fence. I don't know. And one of the things I said to her that night was, I don't believe in the God that you don't believe in either. But I've seen it. And I noticed while I was talking to her that she was beautiful. And I was comfortable in my skin. And all the men in here know that's called a spiritual awakening. And I got off the bus, and I asked her out to dinner. And she said no. In fact, she didn't say no. She said, oh, right, I wait for this bus. Look at my guitar. I've read that book. You know, I have to wait for this bus every night. Like, really mean. And I said, you know, no is a complete answer. And she kind of backed up, and she said, well, no. And I said, great. She went her way, I went mine. I went home to my dad. And said, hey, you know, I met this girl. She felt like home, and I totally blew it. And he goes, I don't think that's over. And I joke about this, but it's true. It's how pathetic I am. I knew I'd grown spiritually because I went to work the next day and I didn't tell anybody she was a lesbian. Totally not my business. I'm okay, you're okay, we're okay. And I went to work and I didn't think about her more than like 130 times that day. And I ran to the early bus to miss her, and she popped up behind me and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "I think I was rude to you." She said, "I don't want to go out with you." I go, "Yeah, you were super clear about that." She said, "But I'll skip this bus and have coffee with you here at the airport. And in July, we're going to celebrate 20 years of marriage." I said to my sponsor before I got married, "She's not blonde, she's not anorexic, she's not addicted to heroin, she's really not my type." And he said, "Yeah, you changed and grew up and you attracted a quality person. My wife is beautiful. My wife is so smart. And one of the greatest things about this relationship for me is she didn't need me." Yeah. "But she wanted to be with me. When we were the first 10 or 15 years of my marriage, sitting next to her was like sitting next to a wild animal. Like anything could happen. She was just there. It's like so exciting for me. So exciting. I've never had to lie to my wife to look better than I am because she accepts me how I am. She's not an Al-Anon. She's not interested in Al-Anon. She never knew her alcoholic when she was drinking. She's not unhealthy that way. But what we came to talk about in this second half is when the other shoe drops. So I met the woman of my dreams. I had a great job, traveled all over the place, had two beautiful children, one of them sitting up in the corner here, and he's not in AA, and he probably wants you all to know that. With the beanie, that's Rory. That's my boy. So everything's beautiful. 5 years of marriage, we didn't have it. We never raised our voices. I remember the first time my wife lied to me. It was because of Rory. He was crying, and we had agreed not to use the bottle anymore. And he was crying, and she went in there, and he stopped crying almost instantly. And I said, "Did you use a bottle with that kid?" And there was just a long enough pause before the, "No," that I knew she had lied to me. And it was okay. I lied to her about how much a guitar cost one time, but we aren't going to talk about that. Anyway, but there's beautiful life, right? I'm going to AA meetings. I'm sponsoring guys. I bought a little house. People are living on my couch. All went well for a while for Jim. And the next line is, he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. I did not. I went to meditation meetings. I did what you told me. I did everything you told me. But there's a lie that they tell you when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't mean to lie to you. They say, anybody new heard somebody come up to me and go, "Are you new?" And you say, "Yes." And they go, "Everything's going to be all right." Anybody say that to you? Raise your hand if somebody said that to you. Yep, it's alive and well. Well, that's not true. They don't mean that. They mean something else. But I came home after 5 years of bliss. Super happy, paying everybody back, almost completely done with my amends. In fact, I was completely done with my amends. Working with others, in love with these guys, going on cool vacations, and my wife's laying on the floor. And her eyes are crossed. And her arms all gimped up. She's having a massive stroke. And everything changed. And I called an ambulance. And my children were with me. And I just walked out the door and got in the ambulance. Because she can't go. And the neighbors scooped my children up. I didn't even look behind me. And I went to the ambulance and to the hospital. And I called Bill. And I called my sister because my parents were dead. And I called her mother in England. And we got to the hospital and she was in such bad shape that they called a helicopter. And I live in a big city. I live in Long Beach, California. There's 500,000 people there. And that hospital wasn't good enough because she was dying. So they put her in a helicopter on the street that Disneyland's on Catella. They blocked it off. And we flew to UC Irvine. We got to UC Irvine. They said, "We're going to do this operation. We're going to make it all okay. We're going to go up through her hip and we're going to drip this stuff on her clot." And when we got in there, they found out that the interior wall of her carotid artery had torn away. No operation. It's over. She's paralyzed. She's brain damaged. She may live if the brain swelling doesn't kill her. But you've got this now for the rest of your life. And it couldn't be. So I left the room. I got her okay. I love her. We were okay. She got whisked away to ICU. And I walked out in the waiting room, and it was full of men from my home group and from Santa Monica. It was packed. I was not alone. I still had all that stuff I did in me. I hadn't failed to enlarge my spiritual life. I called Bill when she first went to the hospital, and I said, Bill, Philip has had a stroke, and I don't know what to do. And he goes, call Jay. I go, I don't want to call Jay. I called you. And he goes, I want you to hang up and call Jay. I'm like, God, what a dick. My wife's in the hospital. So I called Jay. He goes, I go, Jay, my wife had a stroke. He goes, I want you to talk to Adele. I go, I didn't even want to talk to you. I want to talk to Bill. And he goes, I want you to call Adele, talk to Adele. Put Adele on the phone. Adele says, I've had 6 strokes, darling. Let me tell you what's going on right now. And that's what I get in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't get opinion. Well, I get opinions because Bill's my sponsor. But I also get experience, real experience. And those, you know what Jay said to me? He said, hey, man, you've always wanted to be the world's greatest lover. Now's your chance. Well, my wife didn't die, but she didn't get any better. She speaks beautifully. She's funny. She keeps me present, but she's paralyzed on her left side completely, and she's very forgetful. She can't hold a job. She can't take a class. She's tried those things. But what happened? Did AA let me down? Hell no. Did self let me down? It could have. It could have if I relied on myself during that time. But I never left and drifted from AA. And one guy said to me, he goes, you're just so amazing what you're doing, how you're handling all this. Because Rory was 3. Sophie was 1. Phoebe was 8 or 9. And I said, what do you mean? And he goes, well, you could be in Vegas with, you know, cocaine and booze and hookers. And I'm like, God, that sounds disgusting. I just want it to be normal again. And, you know, it is normal again. I've traveled all over the world. Nobody comes up to me and says, my life's been perfectly bland and happy since I got sober. Everybody has something. But everybody has something. I was talking to a guy last night at dinner, and he goes, do you think AA's lost its edge? I said, why? He said, because these meetings I go to, some of them are so foo-foo, and they talk about their day, and they don't get into the steps. Well, they will, because if alcohol doesn't make you want to work the steps, sobriety sure will. That's all I got to say. Thanks a lot.
Oh, God. When that happened, Bill Alcoholic.
Bill.
When that happened, it was around Christmas time. Guys came over to his house and put up the lights, got a tree, put a tree in the house. It was incredible. And he had just started a new job, and he was supposed to go to Chicago for training. And I remember telling him, I said, go to Chicago. There's nothing you can do here. People will mow your lawn, and don't tell them about this. They don't care. And he went to Chicago, and he went through the training, and he's got a great job today. But goddamn, it's been a journey. What a journey. The most spiritual thing you'll hear in AA, get in the car. I mean that. Get in the car. If somebody says to you, hey, we're all going to go here, you want to go, just say yes. You have no idea what's going to happen. You just don't want to be uncomfortable. You don't want to be inconvenienced. Who does? Why would I ever consciously put myself in a position to be uncomfortable? I spent most of my life making sure I was comfortable. AA will take you out of your comfort zone continuously. Sunday I'll be 31 years sober, and I just know that uncomfortable won't kill me now. I kind of look forward to it. I've gotten used to it, people call, are you inconvenient? Absolutely. All the time. I had this drunk call me from Austin, Texas the other night. I'd had a long day in retirement. It was rough on me working on my hot rod and stuff. You know, it was a long day. Karen, my 25-year sober wife, is laying on the couch. We got a movie on. I'm in my bathrobe. I'm settled in. Phone rings. Again. I look at it. It says Austin, Texas. So I answer it. This guy's hammered. I send out daily quotes every day. Some of you may get them, you know. And this guy's drunk on the phone in Austin. And he says, my sponsor sends me all this stuff all the time. And your name is always at the bottom. So I thought I'd give you a call. And I don't want to talk to this guy. You know? He's disturbing me. You know? Just die, man. You know, it's like, you know, that's the first thing. You know? That's how spiritual I am. You know? So, but, you know, drunks will not be denied. He just kept talking, you know? And I said, who's your sponsor? And he couldn't remember his name.
I love that.
He's been coming in and out of AA for 20 years. Doesn't like going outside where there's people and all their BS. And, you know, the only time he goes out of his apartment is to go to the store to get some food and some booze, and then he comes back to the apartment. And I could just picture this guy. You can't you see him? Sitting in his lawn chair in the living room.
Yeah.
Watching the old TV, the big old TV, nothing on the walls, partying. That's the other part of the story. We have a couple of pops, you know, we feel that sense of separation. And I think the whole idea behind the drinking thing was to get out of the house, go to the party, and have some fun, enjoy life. And I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television, taking notes. I'm having sex, menage a uno. We're partying now. You know? I mean, you could answer this question. If there was still a party going on, would we be here? There's no party. Alcoholics don't party, you know. You know, that ended at about 18 years old, 19 maybe, maybe sooner. So once I got into it and started talking to the guy, then he got bored and hung up. I said, so you've been coming in and out for 20 years. You probably had several sponsors. Have you worked the steps? Have you read the book? He goes, oh, I've worked 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, I've worked the steps. I haven't actually done an inventory, but I've worked the steps. You know. So I come into AA. I'm a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got the sponsor. I'm working the steps. I'm going to meetings, and I'm having fun. You know, some people talk about how miserable it was. You know, I was self-conscious, and it was a little weird, but I'm having a good time with you. You know, I'm enjoying going to the meetings, and I love the stories. I have a friend that says he stayed sober just on the stories for the first 6 months, just listening to the stories, you know, and identifying. We identify. Some of us do, and I identified at depth with what was going on here. And I kind of got it right away. There was kind of an understanding that transcends the intellect. I just kind of got it. I figured this is how it's going to be now. It's going to be like this for a while. You know, I never thought I could stay sober, though. I never had before. So I knew that sooner or later something was going to happen. And so far, that hasn't happened. But it's come close. Now, I got into it. He was in general service, so I'm driving him everywhere. You know, I mean, I drove the assault vehicle for years, you know. And he used to ask me, he says, you want to drive? You know, I said, sure. And then finally he'd just look at me and he'd go, get your car. You know, because we're going somewhere. I even stopped asking where. You know, I mean, it just because it was fun. It was fun. And he has this enthusiasm that he's never lost. Just the fun of it, you know, going places, going to panels, going to marathon meetings out in goddamn Norwalk somewhere in the middle of the night, you know, with five other people in the room, you know. It's amazing that you could walk into a place like that and walk out and have had a good time. You know, I mean, we have fun. We used to have marathon meetings at our local Alano Club, and he'd say to me, he goes, on holiday weekends, he'd say to me, so let's go down to the Alano Club and troll for newcomers. You know? He'd call himself the vampire of AA. You know? We'd go down there like at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and just look for them, you know. And there they are. Who else goes to an Alano Club at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning? Nobody that has a life. Us and them, you know. It's like, and we'd get these guys, you know, and we'd stay up for the morning meetings so that we could tell the people at the morning meetings that these are almost AA meetings, but they're way too early, you know. So I got involved right away. I got commitments right away. And, you know, I became a literature guy. Then I became a central service guy, and I got involved in the central office. And at about a year sober, I started sponsoring people, maybe even a little sooner, right around that time. I started sponsoring guys. And unbeknownst to me, maybe not entirely, but all of this, all that I was doing was all ego-driven. All of it, because I don't know any other way. And I'll tell you, early on in your sobriety, motivation is absolutely irrelevant.
Yeah.
If you do the action, the motivation will ultimately change. You'll insert yourself into people's lives, and you will invite them in, and they will actually come. And many times when you don't want them that close, you know, there they are, you know, and it's all happening. Matthew said the same thing with me. Is like, do something good for somebody, don't tell anybody. I don't know that I've ever actually accomplished that. You know, and I'm perfectly convinced that if nobody else knows about it, it really didn't happen. You know, I mean, it's like, and so I'm sharing at every meeting. I'm a relatively verbal individual, and I have a lot to say. And I don't have to have any experience or knowledge on the subject at all. I can just wing it, you know. And, you know, so I'm always up at the podium shooting my mouth off about something, trying to be funny. I remember the first really great speaker I heard was a guy named Cliff Roach. And we Jay and some guys started this meeting that's still going on. This was over 30 years ago. And Cliff was the first speaker there. And I remember sitting right in the front row where he told me to sit at every meeting. And I sat there and I listened to him, and I was so enthralled. I go, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to be the speaker at the meeting. I don't want to be sitting down here with the rest of the sheep. I need to be the leader, you know, the head honcho, the el jefe, you know. I mean, I need to be in charge. I need devotees and stuff, you know. I need all this stuff. So, and you can get all that. You can do that, you know. I mean, I was rapidly making a name for myself in an anonymous organization. Very weird. Very weird, you know. My wife and I was married at the time when I got sober, and she really hated me for very just cause. And, you know, we went to some counseling and stuff, you know, through the recovery place that I went through, and we made a decision because we had these two small kids. One was 3 and the other one was 1 when I got sober. That we would stay together and try to keep the family together. And we became friends again. You know, we became friends. She got into Al-Anon, you know, for quite a while, actually. And she got a lot of benefit out of that. And I was just, you know, nuts about Alcoholics Anonymous to the exclusion of almost all else. But you showed me how to have fun. You showed me how to golf without drinking. I didn't know you could do that, you know. And I'm pretty soon, we're all out golfing until we puke, you know, and just like being alcoholic about everything we do. You know, just going places and going to meetings, just having a great time, just really having a hoot. And I'm sponsoring guys and I'm doing stuff, and, you know, people are getting helped. You know, I'm getting helped and people are getting helped. And at about 8 or 9 years sober, I ran off with an AA girl and just left my family. And in those first years, as Matthew alluded to, I was very opinionated. I'm better now. I'm not completely well, though. You know? And I had a clipboard that had a list of the good people on one side and the bad people on the other. And if you were a bad people in AA and you wouldn't do commitments and stuff, I would make sure that you knew about that and that other people knew as well. So my life was surrounded by chaos. I was chairman of the intergroup, then I got on the board at the central office, and I'm president of Alcoholics Anonymous by this time, you know. And I'm in charge, and I'm creating havoc, you know. Not all the time, but there's a lot of havoc going on. I will never forget, at the intergroup meeting, I said something that this woman took offense to. So I get home, she calls me at home, and she's just reading me the riot act. And I realize that what she thought I said is not what I said. She had misinterpreted what I said, literally. So I corrected her, and I said, no, I didn't say that, I said this. So she admitted that she misheard me, and she continued to berate me anyway. So I called him up, and I said, you know what the problem is? These people are stupid. They're just stupid. I'm surrounded by a bunch of stupid, stupid people. That's what the problem is. And I'm trying to help them, and they're just not capable of grasping, you know. And he says to me, maybe one day you'll get it, Bill. I went, get what? He said, it isn't what you say that pisses people off. It's who you are. And it was like somebody took a big pair of shears and just jammed them into my chest, you know. And by this time, I knew he wasn't trying to hurt me, and I knew it was true. He used to give me instruction. He would say to me, sit down when you talk to people. You're too big, you know, and smile a little. Smile. You know, you're an imposing figure, you know, smile. Don't stand too close and don't point when you're speaking. One time I'm out in front of his house. He lived right on the Strand, right on the beach, you know, and this woman, I was out there, and I was talking to her like this, and he walked in between me and her, and he slapped my hand down. He pushed me back, and he goes, you're standing too close. It just upset me. And so, remember the story. Phony biker, right? Phony. Not real at all. Not real at all. Had the uniform. But clip-on earring, true story. That's true. You know, I was a phony. Alcoholics Anonymous, 9 years sober, phony AA guru, same guy. Stone cold sober, same game, same guy. You know, it doesn't change overnight. I left my family just before Christmas. I called him. He said, you need to go back there. You'll never survive leaving just before Christmas. You can't do this. So I went back. And I, you know, because I had told my wife, I got this girlfriend, I'm out of here. It was hard to do, but I did it. Because I'm selfish and self-centered. I wanted what I wanted. I love my children. I don't not love my children. But I wanted what I wanted. And I left. After the first of the year, I left. Moved in with this girl, and then she dumped me. After like a couple of months, maybe at the most. She just got rid of me, you know. I'm in the storeroom over my office in El Segundo. And I'm as in much pain as I've ever been in my entire life. No medication. I'm ashamed. I'm angry. I'm remorseful. I'm guilty. Who do you blame? Who do you blame when you're sober like that? And I'd done enough inventory and stuff. I mean, I wasn't talking to my sponsor, because when you're president of AA, you don't really need to communicate all the time with just cabinet members, you know? And, you know, so there's no real communication going on. These are all unilateral decisions, you know, formed straight from God through you. And there's no prayer, there's no meditation, there's nothing, you know? You know, have you ever sat with a sponsee and you give him a 20-minute lecture on how he should live his life? And then he leaves the room and you think to yourself, boy, that's some good shit. You know, maybe I should do something. You know? But it's great advice. Great advice. Impeccable. Well thought out. Planned. You know? And so I'm in this storeroom. And one night I was in such pain, I did not know what to do with myself. And I went looking in the medicine chest for something. Advil would have been, I'd have taken a handful of Advil, anything, and there was nothing there. You know, I did that before I made the phone call. Before I made the phone call. And then I made the phone call. Not to my sponsor. He might make me do something, you know. And usually it has to do with prayer and meditation, and, you know, I'm well beyond that. And I called my friend John Biney, and he asked me a question. He said, have you eaten? And I didn't know whether I had or not. And he came over and he got me and he took me out and he fed me. He'd already had dinner. He just watched me eat, bought me a meal. Then he took me to an AA meeting. And I believe that man saved my life. And I walked into my home group, and man, this fall from grace was very public. There were some people that were openly applauding. You know? Thank God he crashed and burned. We knew he was foolish, you know. You know, it's like, it's not like they don't know. You know, they know. And my friend Mike Plank got sober with my sponsor. They got sober together, same around the same time. I come walking in the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, you know, and I'm just, you know, people are looking at me grinning and walking the other way. And, you know, it was awful. And Mike walks up to me and he throws his arms around me and he whispers in my ear. He says, welcome to AA. We've been waiting for you. Because he went through it. I remember when he went through it. He went through it. All of us go through it at some level. Some are more verbose and dramatic and loud, and some are just very quiet. And their crisis is at home. Stuff happens to us. Life happens. You know, we make poor decisions. Sometimes stuff just happens. It just happens. So I went to my sponsor and I said, I think I should quit talking at meetings. There's just too much ego in it. I'm just way too carried away with myself. I needed to shut up. And he says, you don't get to pick and choose what you will and won't do, but I suggest to you, next time you're talking in front of a group of people, why don't you try telling the truth? And I go, what do you mean? I'm not lying. And he goes, quit doing theater and talk about what's really going on. We will understand. And I started doing that. We were at a retreat one time, and I sat down with him, and I was in such pain, I had actually written some stuff down. You know? And we were sitting out at Manresa, and I'm reading my stuff, and I look at him, and I said, you know, I need help. I mean, there's something wrong. I need help. I don't know what's the matter, and I need help. And he looked at me, and he says, go find God. And I went, I don't need mindless platitudes. Don't treat me like some wimpy newcomer. I need some real practical help. Now, he rarely yells at me. Rarely. On occasion. And on this particular occasion, he got up and he leaned over me and he says, "There is nothing else. You talk a good game. Go do it." And I almost hit him. And it really genuinely pissed me off, you know. So I had to start reading the 24-hour-a-day book every morning and praying and asking God for help. And, you know, and I had to start over. I ended up out of that, I did an inventory that was, I still have it. I didn't burn it. I still have it, and I look at it. And I went back from the very beginning and just went through all of it again. I mean, it was, for me, I mean, it was a very cathartic experience. And I did a fifth step with him. And at this point, I'll tell you something. When you're 8-10 years sober, you know, I mean, if you've done the work at all, really, you know it's not them. You want it to be them. Because it looks like them and it smells like them. It's them. You can't be an alcoholic and not know who they are, you know. You know, so when you do that inventory at 10 years sober, you're looking for your faults and mistakes. That's the sole purpose of the inventory, is to find your faults and mistakes. There may not be a part, but there certainly are faults and mistakes. At some time in the past, I put myself in a position to be hurt. People retaliate seemingly without cause. You know, why are they yelling at me like that? Because it's who I am they don't like. This arrogant, pompous, loud, pushy, opinionated guy. He told me one time, as sponsoring guys, he goes, "Bill, when their eyes roll back in their head, you've gone on too long." You know? I mean, and you know it's the truth because you've seen their eyes roll back in their head. I've had guys actually almost fall asleep across the table from me, you know. And so I did the inventory. In this time, I met Karen. We've been together now 22 years. And I met her, and I had grown up. This was a woman that I couldn't dominate, that I couldn't push around. She looked at me one time and she said, "Don't treat me like that." And I looked at her like I do, and I go, "What do you mean?" Like trying to make her feel stupid. And she goes, "You know what I mean." You know, this is a woman that had been around the horn a few times, you know. I mean, she has a very checkered past. I saved her from a life of aimlessly wandering.
That's what happened.
Wandering from man to man. It was like pathetic, you know. And she had this very checkered past, and mine's a little checkered. And we got together, and we're on this path together, which is a whole really another story. But what came out of that horrible thing, man, it has taken me a long time to heal with my family. I mean, it devastated my two children, the two younger ones. It just devastated them, especially my daughter. It was awful, you know. What's wrong with Daddy? You know. And part, you know, it was awful. I mean, and I can't discount that. But what came out of that tragedy, which it really was, I mean, I was just so cold-hearted about it. I can't believe it myself. Is I've got a whole other life now with somebody that I've never cheated on. She has her program, I have mine, and we're walking the path together. You know, she sponsors a lot of girls, I sponsor a lot of guys. We try to keep separated. And she tries to hook them up, which is not good. And, she says, "That guy Joe, is he okay?" And I go, "No, Karen, none of them are okay." You know? And I started praying and I started meditating again, you know. And for me, that's been an off and on thing, you know. But I got much more into the spiritual literature, and you know, it's been a journey for me, a long journey. And The growing up process, deepening emotionally, is experiential. It's not intellectual. The big book is not the truth. It's a pointer towards the truth. So if it's pointing, I should understand it really well so I can see where it's pointing. But it's led me, and he's led me into other realms, other places. So has Matthew. Matthew's been very helpful to me. You know, reading stuff and trying to understand it and grasp it and wrap my head around the fourth dimension, which is where all the solution to all my problems are. You know? So that's enough out of me. Thank you very much. Yay. Yay. Clean M. Jay, alcoholic.
Jay.
So, all my problems are three-dimensional. And all my solution is in the fourth. Now, I want to tell you that you know, Bill has talked very candidly about some things in his life, and one of the but I also want to say that during that time he did yeoman's work in Alcoholics Anonymous. He sponsored a lot of people, that sponsored a lot of people, carried the message, did a lot of stuff. So, you know, it's like we all have our stuff that we're working through and that we're working on. And one of the great things about being in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we aren't all whacked at the same time. And so, for me, I have had a I've had this great and fascinating, and I've been on a pink cloud for 36 years. I've known this guy for 31 now. It doesn't mean that I haven't had problems. And the thing is being able to accept responsibility for the problem and being able to walk through it in dignity and grace. Example. I got the girl, wife number two, version 2.0. I've got this great business where I've got four coffee bars on a college campus and one across the street. My business card said purveyor of fine stimulants. And it's a hub for AA and all this stuff, and I'm working, but I was brought up in a family where my father said to me, you take 25% of what you earn and you save it. You take 25% of what you earn and you use that for your rent. And then you take the other 25% and you use that for your car and your other living expenses. And then you got 25% to play with. That was the amount of financial instruction that I got. And I was raised in a household where violence came around any conversation with money. And when my folks split up, I mean, it was bad. My dad never ever modeled that behavior. And so I get sober, and I had this great job, and I'd gotten a sales career, and I was gone a lot, and it kind of messed with the first family, and so I decided, well, I'm gonna quit that, I'm gonna open a business. Now I got a great personality. And I opened these coffee bars, and I'd been in the bar business, and it was something that came natural to me, and I had a great time. But I didn't know how to ask for help with something that I didn't know.
And so my solution to my problem is you just keep opening more locations. You get more money. You pay off what's going on. And finally, what happened is that the college that I had the arrangement with, they asked me to do something that none of the people that I'd been a subcontractor had done, which was pay them the rent. I mean, they'd actually come to me. This college had come to me after Marriott walked away and said, we can't make any money with this. We're out of here. They came to me and said, will you provide the food service on this college, community college campus? And I said, yes, obviously God's will. And I don't have the chops to run the money. I can run the front of the house, and I don't know how to ask for help. And they came to me, and they said, we want you to pay us. And I said, well, you didn't get that from Marriott. And they said, do it now or close the doors. So I closed the doors because I didn't have the money. Because I'd been, you know, I'd invested in stuff that I was robbing Peter to pay Paul. And so that crumbles. And then finally, about 7 months later, the house of cards can't stay anymore. And I got to walk to the landlord of my coffee bar and give him the keys back. Now, that'll get you right-sized. And there wasn't anybody that I could blame for that. There wasn't anybody I could blame for that. And I didn't have the ability to ask for help. Could for my sponsor, could about all kinds of things. But when it came to being honest about money, I couldn't do it. And now I'm in a situation. I got another job. It was a great story. I'm sitting there and I'm going, Jesus, I'm going to close this place. I don't have any dough. What's going to happen? And I look at a bottle of the syrup that I was using, Da Vinci syrups, and I went, I've never seen a Da Vinci rep. And I'd been a rep in the sales, in the food service sales before, and I went, oh, that's interesting. So I walked over, and I picked the phone up, and I called them. Oh, no, they're, you know, I said, who would I speak to about that? Oh, let me take your number. Guy calls me back 20 minutes later, and he goes, who are you? And I told him, and he goes, well, I just left a strategic planning meeting where I was going to hire a rep in California. Can you meet me in a couple weeks up at the food service show? And I did. And, you know, so I was able to care for myself take care of myself. One of the things that I didn't do was that when I was busy trying to keep all the wolves at bay is that I didn't pay the taxes. Okay, and it really came home to roost on a couple different occasions. Now this I'm talking about a problem. The problem is thinking that I know what I don't know, and not being able to ask for help, okay? And I could have asked for help 3 years earlier, probably even a year and a half earlier, and we would have been able to take care of all that. And then I get this sales job, and it's going along good, and then that company gets sold, and I go to work for somebody else, and blah, blah, blah. And suddenly I'm 50 years old, 50, maybe 52 years old, and I don't have a college degree, and I can't get a call back to save my life. And one of the other things I want to say to you guys in here, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I came into an Alcoholics Anonymous that was still very much about plug in the jug, work with others, make sure that you're not, you know, that you're there wasn't the experience that we have now about that you can do anything, that you can do anything sober. And that's the other thing I want to tell you, is you can do anything. And there's a bunch of younger guys in here. I came in when I was 24 years old, younger gals. The one thing where I really hit the wall was I reached a point in the information age where I couldn't talk my way into a job anymore. And so don't get the paper. They don't care if you know what the hell it is you're going to do. I went to Matthew one time and said, can you help me? And he said, you don't got the paper, I can't. There's nothing I can do. There's nobody I can talk to. And they didn't care that his paper was in English literature, and he sells drugs. You know?
Skin care.
Yeah.
He's useless.
Yeah. But anyway, the thing is the other thing that I want to say is that in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, every woman and man that I've met and that I've encouraged and that's gone along and gotten the paper, it has never hurt them. Okay. Dream deeply. I've talked about the problems. And, it really came back to bite me a couple years ago. So I'm asked to go speak. You know, I go speak. And when we're talking about problems, the problem is maybe 8% of my life. The other 92% is amazing. But I got this thing that I'm always, always grinding on. Anyway, I get called to speak in Sedona, Arizona. Now, I live in Redondo Beach. I sponsor all the great people in AA, or they're the grand sponsor. I go to the best meetings in the world. I know everybody. I'm connected. I got the trophy wife. I've got life like you can't even believe. And I get asked to go speak at this thing in Sedona. So I go to Sedona. I like the town. It reminds me of Laguna when I went to high school there back in 1970 and 71, when, you know, it was just artists, homosexuals, and dope dealers. It was a great place to grow up, you know. And I go to this thing, and when I got down from the podium after giving my share, the voice said to me, "Move here now." Now, the reason I meditate is to distinguish the voice from the voices. Okay? And it doesn't take a lot of practice. And anyway, my wife had a similar experience that day. I didn't know it. And I scoot up next to her and go, "Baby, I just got told to move here." And she goes, "I knew that." And we went back to Redondo and we took a walk a couple of days later, and I realized I'd had every wonderful experience a man could ever have in Los Angeles. Why not be open for something else? 3 garage sales later, we point our car east. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. but at the time, my wife's retired, and I'm underemployed, and I'm working with my... I wrote a book called Loving Sober, a field guide to spiritual intimacy, to try and share what it was that had happened in my life and with my wife. And, you know, it's a wonderful practice. So I'm doing that over Skype and folks, but I'm not really making enough money at the time. And so I can do that anywhere. So we're off. We gave the keys to a realtor and said, you know, make the place vanilla and sell it. And we find a place that we like in Sedona. The house was in my wife's name. It was her home because of my financial difficulties. They start doing the paperwork. And they find that there are 3 liens from the tax obligation that I was paying a little bit at a time. But I didn't know that they'd put a lien on her house. even though it's her house. That got the prenup, all that stuff. They don't care. And there we are in Sedona, and I got a debt of over $180,000. I'm not working. I got no car. And we danced around the pain for a few days, and she said, baby, you got to go. And at 34 years sober, I'm back at the home group. I'm sleeping in an extra room with one of the guys that I sponsor, and I got no idea. No idea what's up. None. But I have experience, and I want to talk to you a moment about, it's not because I had faith. I had experience. I'd walked through a lot of stuff, and I didn't know if I was ever going to be able to get back with Adele again. And this woman is my muse. And I didn't know how this was going to work out. But I knew that I could walk through anything with dignity and grace because I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had been doing the right thing. Now, she was not in the mind to see the right things that I'd done. And how could she? How could she? And we didn't know if we'd even get back together again. And I mean, we'd been inseparable from the first day I'd approached her. And so I go to the home group and I tell the truth. I don't describe it specifically, but you know, what's he doing back? I mean, I'd only been gone for 2.5 weeks on the spiritual pilgrimage with her. And I'm back in the home group. What the f*** is up with that? And anyway, I've been at this guy's house. I'm back in town for about 2.5 weeks. Now, fortunately, I knew a talented lawyer, Bobby V. And he got on it, and he was well connected, and he got three different tax agencies to admit that they were in error and take the liens off the house. Amazing. I mean, you want to talk about miraculous, that's pretty good. Next thing is, I haven't been able to get a call back on a job in forever. And I'm sitting there, desperate, and I get on the computer again, and this job comes across for a sales director at a retreat house in Sedona. And I've like organized and led retreats for 20 years. I borrow a car. I drive to this place. We have a meeting. And just before the meeting, I'm sitting out on this bench in this big, and I don't know what's up. I really don't. And this big blue heron just goes, lands right in front of me. We sat there for a half an hour together. And I knew that everything was all right. I didn't know how it would work out. But a week later, they call me, offer me the job. I go back to Sedona. Now that I got a job, same friend sells me a car on very generous terms, you know. He'd been trying to unload that thing, and I was, and it worked. And I'm back in Sedona, and I got a cool ride, and I got insurance, and I got a job. And I asked the girl to come and see me, you know. And we go walking around this place, and the pain was so deep that we couldn't celebrate what was going on. We start having coffee. And a couple weeks after that, I get a call that she's come to the retreat center. Now, in order to get to the retreat center, you got to go down 11 miles down a primitive road. And they told me that Adele was there, had been there. And I'm going, why didn't she call me? You know, what's up? I'm thinking, oh, my God, there's something else that's happened. And I go rushing down to the office, and there's a dozen red roses. and a card that says, "Come home to me, it's time." Okay. And that's turned into the best job I've ever had on every level. One of the things about that that I need to tell you is that because I was always paying the child support, and I was always, you know, I always had some tax obligation I was paying, I was always saying that I wasn't making enough, no matter what, how good it was during the, these years, whether I was making a big salary or no salary. It never felt any different. And the one thing I said to her when I took this job at the retreat center was, I said, "I'm never going to apologize for what I'm making." Because what I went to work for and what I still go to work for, well, what I went to work for was a little salary and a little percentage. And I still got the little salary, and I still got the little percentage. But what has happened has just been amazing. And so I have this, I have a life that's fulfilling on every level, but the thing was, is I quit apologizing for this thing that had been upon me. And we got the home that we wanted, and you know, the girl and I are better than we've ever been. But it wasn't about faith. I was leaning on my experience about having problems in Alcoholics Anonymous and being able to walk through it with dignity and grace. There are three guys that I call before I call my sponsor. I got a guy in Connecticut. I got a guy in Indianapolis. And I got a guy in Hawaii when things are really bad. And I had to call each of them up. And I had to call him up. And I had to call him up. And I had to call my friend Mildred in Toronto up. And I had to call my big AA buddies up. And I had to tell them not that I was bad, but that this was the condition that my life was in, and these were the circumstances. And that's what allowed me to walk through it with grace. I wasn't crying the poor mouth. See, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know that I'm the problem. Okay? And if I'm the problem, there's a solution here. And you can walk through anything. Now, why is it that I'm so confident in that? Because I've been to the hospitals when people have had their babies. And I've been to the hospitals. I get calls to the hospitals when their babies are dying. And I have had every experience in between. You know, rejoicing about Matthew and then walking through the problem with it. You know. So there's nothing. See, we have here something that is unique. At least for males, but I believe it's for my sisters in the fellowships too. Is that we are not raised with information. We are not mentored. Those of us who are raised in alcoholic and drug addicted homes, we don't get any instructions. We don't get any guidance. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we can get that mentorship in just about anything if we are able to ask. So why do I share with you those things about me which I wish were not true? So that if you don't suffer one day short, if you suffer one day shorter than I did, all of my pain is worthwhile. And the great thing about what it is that we share is that there is no hierarchy. Neither of these guys have to act like me, and that's, you know, and they're very grateful for that. But the thing is that this is not a hierarchical society. We share freely of what it is that we're given. And so what I want to encourage you to do is that get those people that you can tell the truth to. That's the most important relationship that you can have in AA. Notice when he was up against it, he didn't call me. he called John. And so the fellowship is much, much deeper than any personal relationship. And we're going to talk a lot about how we can go about having a wonderful, wonderful experience in this. But I want you to know it's not hierarchical. It's not about we're going to salute this guy and down. Because that's not what Bill Wilson wanted. That's not what Dr. Bob wanted. And they knew that we wouldn't tolerate it. Every year, what I do is I ask myself a question. And the question is, if I could do anything in the world, what would I do? Anything. When I first really got fired up on meditation, and I want to share one thing with you because some of you might not be here tomorrow or Sunday, but I want to burn this in your head. One of my teachers taught me was, 5 years from now, it's not going to matter who you sleep with tonight, what you drive, who you work for. The only thing that's going to matter is, did you meditate today? He threw that one down on me. I was 15 years sober at the time, and I bought it. I bought it. And I can tell you. I can tell you. There's that component of it. But through this, what I've done, when I got all lit up on that 15 years ago, he and I put together a website to help people learn to meditate. And it's impacted lots and lots of people. I'm a historian of the I'm a history geek and I've done research at Stepping Stones and GSO and I've done a whole bunch of stuff with things like that. I've been to the Oxford Group place in Coe, Switzerland. And had one of the most amazing experiences of my life. So I don't know what it is that's in your heart. But if you dream deeply and you keep doing this thing, all is possible for you. All is possible. Not the stuff, but your heart will open in ways that you never could imagine. Thank you.